Hemp seed is for the birds, and actually, it's the Häagen-Dazs in the seed realm. How many actual and potential uses of this plant need to come to light before the seeds can be sown is a question posed by today's guest, geneticist and co-founder of the North American Industrial Hemp Council, Dr. David West. Part two's coming up. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
Another thing you were asking about the soils. Traditionally, the term hemp land was applied to the best soils. So hemp, like if you look, for instance, in the Ukraine, that part of the world that is still major hemp-producing area, you find that the hemp lands were the best. They wanted the best soil, good tillage. They really went to a lot of work to make sure that that soil was in good tilth. And so the idea that, you know, just because the plant can go weedy and can grow in some fairly difficult areas doesn't mean that's where you're really going to want to crop it, okay? It grows well in rotation with corn and on the same kind of soil that corn would grow on. So it really belongs back here in the Midwest as a rotational crop with soybeans. Back when I first got involved, I made contact with some people who were growing organic soybeans for Japan, exporting them to Japan, and they got a huge premium on their organic soybeans. But the problem was they couldn't find enough organically certified land, and weed control in soybeans is a difficult task. So I got together with a fellow, and we put together a proposal to the Wisconsin Ag Department that the idea would be to grow organic soybeans using hemp as the weed control in rotation. Of course, that didn't get funded or go anywhere. That was, you know, 1995 or something.
That's a great idea, though.
But I thought it was a good idea.
Yeah.
I still think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, if you can grow hemp in rotation with crops for the weed control, that opens up all kinds of possibilities. And then what you do with the crop after that can go in any number of directions. The fiber, of course, used to be the primary product, but the fiber is becoming a byproduct. First of all, the seed seems to be the new market for hemp, which means entirely different varieties than what you used to have for fiber. And curiously, the real byproduct of the old fiber industry was what's called the herds, which are the inner woody core of the plant that gets broken up and becomes like little pieces of balsa wood. They've discovered this ancient use, combining it with lime to make what's called hempcrete for building products. And it has all kinds of positive environmental characteristics, carbon negative, in terms of insulation and vapor permeation, all of that kind of stuff. So right now, if I were putting my money in it, I think that's the direction that the crop has a huge potential.
Yes. Could you give us a little bit, when you talk about crop rotation, what would that look like? You would grow soy 1 year or 5 years and then do hemp for 1 year or 5 years, or how would that realistically look?
You know, agronomists would work that out empirically, but you'd probably have, right now you tend to go corn, soybeans, and perhaps alfalfa up in my area anyway. Or else if you're down in Iowa, you're probably going corn, soybean, corn, soybean, corn, soybean. So you throw hemp in there anywhere, and it's a nice break. How many years? It would be one or two. It wouldn't be more than that. Soybeans, you usually don't grow for more than one at a time. So I would expect a rotation like that. Throw alfalfa in there for a good measure. You'd need that to stay in the field for about 4 years.
Cool. Well, I recently did read, and I'll let everyone know, just to give Doug Fine some good credit here. He's come out with a book. I believe it's coming out in April, entitled Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. And David, as you know, this is where I found out about you and sought you out for you to help shine some light here on this topic for us today. And I read that China is about to give up on cotton, according to one of his sources, and go more with hemp because cotton uses so many pesticides and cotton needs so much water. Now, but I've also heard that cotton has a way of absorbing toxins, unlike other plants, from the air. And I was wondering, do you have any information about that, and or peripherally, what would you say to people that are going to go with hemp and give up on cotton?
I would say to them, go for it. cotton is certainly the most pesticide-intensive crop that we grow. I think tobacco runs a close second, but we don't grow much of it anymore. But cotton, you know, the cotton agriculture of the Soviet Union basically killed the Aral Sea, so it's a polluter. But it's also a crop that a lot of people are dependent on. And looking back in the history, around 1933, I mentioned that the USDA had a program of hemp breeding up until 1933. Well, what was the Department of, what was it called, the Fiber Investigations, in that year as part of the New Deal became the Department of Cotton and Other Fibers. So there's the turning point right there.
Yes.
Cotton was going to be the only crop, only fiber crop in America. And hemp, you know, hemp's fate was sealed at that point. I think that any time you can replace cotton with hemp, you're doing the world a favor.
You just mentioned the hempcrete. Is there anything that you've heard that you feel like I would not go in that direction, or you would go in a certain direction for other products of hemp that you've become aware of or that you've known about, obviously?
Plastics.
Yes.
Plastics. They're doing neat things with plastics that are deriving from hemp. There's an old expression that said anything you can do with a hydrocarbon, you can do with a carbohydrate. And people who are, you know, coming to hemp from that point of view think hemp would be a great crop in what was called the chemergic approach to agriculture. In other words, trying to find industrial inputs from the farm field instead of paying farmers not to grow. This was an old idea. It's one I explored in one of my essays, but it was called chemergy at the time. And it's kind of come back in other guises. And hemp has a lot to offer. I mean, my question to people who, you know, are on the fence about hemp is really how many uses does it need to have before we have enough?
Yes.
I used to ask legislators, I'd say, well, what's the magic use? You know, if I show you I can do these things and you're still sort of, you know, hemming and hawing, you know, what's the magic use? If I showed you the crop could do that, you know, then you'd say, aha, okay. Well, there really isn't one, since there are just people with motivations to place obstructions in this crop's way. And there, you know, it doesn't seem to matter how many good ideas you come up with. They still hem and haw.
Right. Well, I think we're coming out of that hemming and hawing. It's kind of reminding me of...
We're also only 2 years away from a possible Bush presidency again, you know, so let's be realistic here. I had to be realistic. When I did the Hawaii project started in 99, it was under the Clinton administration, right?
Right, yes.
And before we had gone on very far, we were under a Bush administration, and 9/11 happened. It became pretty obvious that hemp was not about to come rushing back into American agriculture at that point. So, you know, the winds of change can blow, and this country is great at, you know, the pendulum swings and the backlashes that come. So I want people in you know, who are involved with this to, you know, be realistic and not start counting their chickens too fast. Lots of progress has been made, but more progress has been made in the area of marijuana and medical marijuana than has been made in hemp. So I think we have to be aware of that.
Yes.
Some years ago, I told a friend that marijuana would be legalized before hemp, and he thought that was rather funny. But I think I've been borne out on that.
Yes, it's funny when you were talking about the hemming and hawing. My mind immediately went to the hee-hawing of an ass, and it's like, okay, everyone.
Okay.
Yeah. Can you talk a moment or two about the bioremedial potential? I saw an article you wrote that talked about it and how brilliant it would be, for instance, in coal mining areas.
Okay. Oh, I know what you saw. Well, I suggested that. Actually, it was suggested to me that if Kentucky was going to do some experiments, that maybe they could put it out there on that on the lands where they've been cutting the top off the mountains and see if it could help out. Hemp seems to work well for bioremediation. Work was done at Chernobyl. It will take up heavy metals, and then if you used it in the building trades, that wouldn't matter. You wouldn't obviously use it for food. There's, you know, lots of crops are bioremediators. Hemp's not the only one. But hemp has attractive features, one obviously being that, you know, you can use it in non-food ways. So, you know, grow it in Colorado. What's the Superfund site that you have there? Rocky Flats.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Okay. Well, there's a place where I think it would be excellent to seed in some hemp and let it go and just see what it does. You know, it's certainly, you're not going to hurt it, right?
Yes. No. Not at all.
Let's give it a try. See, here's for me the bottom line. I keep coming back to is that I don't think I should have to justify this crop. You know, I don't think I should have to come up with another great thing you can do with hemp or that hemp can do or, you know, that it can cure cancer or save the planet or whatever. I really think that when you have a crop that has been humanity's resource for millennia, that if somebody suddenly takes that away from you, they should have a very good reason. And the onus lies there, not with the people who are trying to prove that this crop, you know, can be the super crop of all. Maybe it's not. If it's not, does that mean that we can't grow it? Why? Those are my questions.
Yes, and I'm sure there's no doubt that you know the beauty of nature, period. If it's there, it's there for a reason.
We would like to think.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Although hemp did not come about, you know, nature is one thing, but let's realize that hemp is a product of the, you know, of human artifice, all right? On both sides of the cannabis equation, it's human artifice. These things were made through the actions of humans over millennia, doing the slow, tedious process of selecting. And whether you're talking about hemp or whether you're talking about high-test cannabis, in both cases, you can see the hand of ancient breeders. Probably more so in the case of the of what I call the high test, because you know, somewhere back in antiquity, somebody sitting in northern Afghanistan, a lot of somebodies were doing something. You know, this didn't come about. I often compare it to the udder on a cow. Okay, if you go into a modern dairy and you look at the cows and you look at the udder, you know that cow wouldn't have an udder like that in nature, right?
Yes, yes.
In the same way, if you look at varieties of cannabis that are oozing resin so that people can walk through the fields with leather aprons and just scrape the resin off, this is not a state of nature. This is something that has been produced by ancient breeders. And I think that raises interesting questions. Who were they? Where were they? What were they doing? You know? So we have all kinds of questions, and I hope that the when they have a map developed there, hopefully at Boulder, that some of those questions can be addressed.
Yeah, just recently I saw some information about how using the hemp, because it's one of the differences between the hemp and the cannabis or marijuana with the THC is that the hemp has the CBD.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, as I read in your article, the anti-marijuana. And,
well, it binds but prevents the and then prevents the binding of THC. That was work done by Rick Musty in Vermont that showed that THC would bind and then block the binding sites for THC. So, you know, someone smoking hemp won't be able to get stoned. You know, this is you want another anecdote?
Sure.
This is how I learned this lesson early on. I was a student in 1966 in Madison, Wisconsin, a freshman, newly minted freshman at my dormitory. What was it? Og Hall. Oh, I'm surprised that came back to me. But anyway, Og Hall. It was this big, tall, like 12-story, 13-story dormitory, all right? And my roommate had gone to his girlfriend's house. to her father's farm somewhere down by the Mississippi, and he came back with a shoebox. He was pretty excited, and he opens it up. He says, "Look what I found growing all over." And I said, "Well, you know, I mean, I was pretty young and naive at the time." And so, anyway, fast forward a couple of hours, and I come back to the dorm, and the elevator door opens, and there's this smell wafting down the hallway, right? And I meet the hall steward as I'm coming out and going to my room, and the smoke is pouring out from under the door of my room. And we open the door, and there's my roommate, and the clouds of smoke whirling around him. And he said, "I'm not high at all. I smoked the whole box."
Oh, my gosh.
So years later, you can imagine, I remembered this story. It was at the time, it was just, you know, we cleared the smoke out so he wouldn't get in trouble. But years later, I remembered that, and I thought, well, that was a foreboding of things to come. You know, it was my first lesson in the difference between hemp and marijuana.
Yes, and recently, just seeing how people are actually moving to Colorado Springs because some brothers are...
Yes, amazing. We've seen the news, national news stories on that.
Right, are helping children with seizure control. And
that's right.
And the property that's doing that, apparently, is the CBD.
Yeah.
So is that a...
What they really need, though, here's the thing. You know, when you have high THC varieties of cannabis, they, you know, the THC is put in the resin that forms in the trichomes. And you get this abundant production, this overproduction that I compared to the udder on a cow. In the case of hemp, you really don't have that proliferation of the trichomes, so you don't get that massive resin production.
I see.
So I mean, yes, there's CBD. If you look at the profile of hemp versus marijuana, yes, the CBD factor is comparatively high versus THC, but there's not a lot of it. Okay? The resin, the total resin production. So it's a matter of, you know, you produce resin, but what cannabinoid are you depositing in that resin? And in the case of marijuana, you're depositing THC. In the case of hemp, you're depositing CBD in preponderance. And so what has happened with these brothers that you refer to is that they have basically a variety of marijuana, but it's producing CBD. Now, that could be done through genetics and selection. It really wouldn't be that difficult if you had the right instruments to measure and assay and do all of that. But that's the direction you go. I think the idea that the crop that's growing in Nebraska, say, could be used directly, it's worth exploring. And certainly, through the century that they had for that material to just mutate and vary, you know, at will, has probably produced some interesting variations that might be useful, but kind of in a developmental, not in an off-the-shelf kind of way. So I don't think you're going to, be able to just go into the Nebraska stands, but, you know, might be better than nothing. The other thing is, of course, that I've been told that one of the best ways to quit smoking is to smoke Nebraska green. That makes some sense. You know? I mean, you smoke it, it's just a smoke. You get the pleasure of the smoking thing. You're not getting the high. But you're also getting the calming effect of CBD. And so, you know, maybe the people in Nebraska looking to make an industry out of hemp should, you know, roll it.
Wow, that's interesting. So it's less offensive to the body than tobacco?
I'm not a tobacco smoker. You'd have to...
Oh, you were talking about pot smoking, you mean?
No, according to, this is anecdotal, all right?
Yes.
This is what people have told me, but that they found that they were able to get off cigarettes by smoking just the green, you know, the Nebraska green. It would be like smoking corn silk, but at least you get a little CBD in the mix.
Right, I see. Is there anything that you think the next 5 years will bring out that's not really circulating as information right now?
That's a bit of a crystal ball question. I'd probably have to give it more thought. I hope that we see some major building projects where we can really demonstrate the potential of hempcrete. There's so many, over the years I've heard so many good ideas, and then for some reason they never get off the mark. And I would really like to see this building idea move, because it's just good for the planet. It's good for everything. It'll be good for people living in the buildings. This is going strong in Europe, in England, particularly. So we're really always playing catch up on this, and I think that's unfortunate, because we were supposed to be the land of the free, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
The idea that some self-interested bureaucracy in Washington is just going to kind of come along and say, well, we've decided that makes our work harder, so you can't grow that.
Yeah.
There's something repugnant about that.
Well, it would seem, and correct me if I'm wrong, that during this time of creating a new and better hemp seed, which is going to take some time, as you've stated earlier, that product could be a very good product to use for building.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Not the long track. You could probably get off the ground on that one pretty quickly. And if we have to, we'll import, which is what we do have to do now, import from Canada. But, why do we have to? It really smacks up against our notion of ourselves, I think, as a country, doesn't it? It does to me. I mean, I looked at this stuff and I kind of went, whoa, they're taking away and for such a paltry reason. So anyway, that was my knee-jerk reaction 20 years ago.
Yeah, your knees are twitching still, I bet.
They are.
And before we close, we have to talk about your favorite guy.
David Meyerly is one of my favorite subjects. David Meyerly is interesting because he was like the original, hemppreneur, the original true believer. And there's a book called The History of Hemp, of the Hemp Industry in Kentucky, that was written as a doctoral dissertation in 1950 by James Hopkins. And it was reissued again around 1999 or something. Anyway, it's available. And in that book, he describes David Meyerly and how he had struggled to get the Navy to buy domestic hemp for its, the Navy's ran on hemp.
Yes.
And the hemp that the U.S. Navy had been using was all imported. It was coming largely from Russia, maybe from Italy. They had water-retted hemp as opposed to our own dryland-retted hemp. And the hemp that was being grown in the United States, this is in the 1840s, it was used primarily for cotton baling, to wrap the cotton bales. That was the principal economic use for the hemp that was being grown. And so Meyerly said, and it was a reasonable argument, that, there's no reason we can't produce quality water-retted hemp. And he kept trying and trying, and his businesses failed. And he moved west, to Missouri. We have records of him trying to grow in Missouri. And then the last thing we hear about Meyerly, which makes this story interesting, I think, is that he had gone off and wanted the federal government to support his effort to teach the Native Americans on the reservation to grow hemp. And so we have the invoice. We have actually quite a stack of documents, correspondence that between Washington and Meyerly. He was trying to get paid and everything. But we have an invoice from the Indian agent at Fort Leavenworth who had delivered hemp seed to the Indians. He wanted to be reimbursed for the $160 in hemp seed. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was quite a lot of hemp seed, probably.
It must have been, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, they did. They grew hemp. Seed was brought in. They seemed to be going all right. But then we don't hear any more about it. And then while I was looking into this subject, thinking that the feral hemp that's growing in Nebraska had come from a short-lived industry that was there around the turn of the last century, around 1905 or so, they tried to develop a hemp industry in Nebraska because they needed the fiber for baling twine. They had now the new harvester that used twine to bind up the wheat. So it was suggested that this would be a good thing in Nebraska, and they had started getting the industry off the ground. And I assumed that the feral hemp in Nebraska had escaped from that until I learned about Meyerly. And then I realized that it's more probable that all this hemp that's growing out there, probably comes from his effort, which means it was from a much earlier introduction of hemp into that environment. In fact, it was from an introduction that predates 1850. Why is that important? Remember I mentioned about the missionary sending hemp back from China in 1850?
Yes.
That would mean that a lot of the hemp that's growing out there is actually a unique pool that would trace its roots to the original European hemp.
Yes.
And so what we have in Nebraska is the meeting of hemp that was grown post-Chinese with hemp that was pre-Chinese. That means that you're going to have this amazing release of genetic variation, and so it makes that an even more important repository of genetic material. So one of the things that we have to do is get into Nebraska somebody who can make a collection and preserve it properly, because that really is a trove of hemp genetics. And when the people there at Boulder have their map together, they can go in there and start looking at it from a genetic point of view. I think it should be quite interesting.
Yes, yes. Well, it would be something.
I hope they're listening, guys.
Yes.
Go to Nebraska.
I will make sure. If not, I'll call you up and we'll take a road trip.
There we go.
Thank you so much, Dr. David West, for joining us and sharing all of this information. I think it was definitely a great perspective on what's going on, which I think
is
kind
of lacking.
It's been
fun. I hope people look into it. We've only scratched the surface, obviously, and you know, I often tell people when they're starting to look into hemp, I say, you know, you think you're stepping in a puddle, but you're stepping in a well, and quickly you go sploosh, and you're over your head, and you're dealing with conspiracies, and you're dealing with the CIA, and you're dealing with all kinds of things you didn't know you were gonna. You were just looking for a good crop to plant in rotation or something. So this is a big issue, and I learn things. I think I've heard every story, and then I hear another one that surprises me. So it's a fascinating subject, and I think in some ways it has been sort of empowered and potentiated by the obstruction that it has suffered. Maybe
exactly.
We wouldn't have realized all of hemp's potential if someone hadn't tried to block it.
Dr. David West, his well runs deep. Newheadnews.com/hemp has some very, very well written articles. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.